So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review,
right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
Generico crawling toward that steel chair. It's what started it all,
Kevin. Yeah, the blood is still on that chair. The living embodiment of that shirt. And now...
Welcome to Review Away. I'm John Pollock, returning with Wei Ting. Wei, it's been 3 weeks since you and I have done this particular show together.
Man. Or has it?
I think it has.
Well, yeah. Or has it?
I have no idea. I have no clue.
Okay, never mind.
Okay, well.
It feels like we were just here a few days ago.
We weren't, though.
Okay, let's do this.
I said this particular show, this particular Review Away.
Yeah, we did do it. We did it exactly 3 days ago.
No. That's a different show. That's a different show we do.
What was it different?
I said this particular show. It would be like...
It was Review Away.
No, on Monday?
No.
What are you
on
talking
about? On Friday.
On Friday?
Yeah.
What?
We did a review.
Oh,
because no.
Oh
no,
my God!
No one's gonna get this. Let's.
No way! This is the best start.
No, let's actually start over.
All right, me and Wei.
No,
did
no.
Our first ever secret review. Secret.
No, it's not even.
Only three people in the world will ever get to hear a special review. Do you want to give some context to our secret review?
Not really. No, let's start over. No, we're just going to confuse people.
No, I'm not stopping at all. No.
I'm going to hit the stop button right now.
We did a...
We're just going to confuse people. Seriously, I don't think people will get...
Okay, well, the secret review will stay secret.
It'll stay secret.
Okay. Only, What are you... Take your hand off that mouse. You hit stop, you'll be hitting stop on this friendship. This keeps
all
going.
Right. It's fine.
Get your finger away. You're making me very nervous. I'm trigger happy.
I'm just like, let's just stop this. Yeah, let's just start over.
Not at all.
The more I talk, the more it's just going to hurt.
How was your Tuesday?
Okay, we're going to start over, right?
I'm not starting over again.
Well, I don't have to.
I will pick up mid-sentence. If you start this, it's going to be the worst start ever because I'm not going to introduce the show. I'm not going to say anything.
We don't have to.
I'm going
to
pick up from this. What did you do on Tuesday? Answer the question.
I feel like I'm being held hostage here.
You are.
On the microphone. You know, I don't know what to do.
There's no leaving. You're the El Generico to my Kevin Steen.
I could leave this.
And this podcast is going to be a suplex onto a upright chair. I'm going to break your back.
Well, I could just say nothing right now. There'd be no show.
And that'd be very, very much be the El Generico to my Steam. Us two Canadians.
It's very uncomfortable right now. I don't want it.
Well, let's make it comfortable.
Don't want to be in this situation.
Let's
start the show over.
Are you missing the Pan Am Games? They're done. What do you think about toll roads in Toronto? These HOV lanes being turned into permanent toll roads.
Are you ready to start the show over?
I'm trying to get something out of
you. I just want a clean start.
What do you think about the next Expendables where Randy Couture will be playing his character Toll Road? Why is this podcast taking such a toll on you? How are you, Wei? Welcome back to the show. Pretend we're just starting new.
Alrighty.
Are you doing well?
Doing fine.
How's your jiu-jitsu game going?
Honestly, not that great.
I know.
You know?
You've kind of fallen.
I think with a lot of things, a lot of my passions in my life, I go through peaks and valleys. There are things where I just like really get into them, and I get into them for maybe like a year or 2 years, and then I just kind of I hit a plateau, and I need a bit of a break. And maybe, you know, with jiu-jitsu, it's maybe gotten to that point. I just haven't necessarily felt the motivation. They say that it's actually quite common amongst people who, once you get to kind of a blue belt, it's such a, for a lot of people, like it's such a long journey, you know, it seems, just to even get there. And then once you get there, you know, wow, you need that much more time to even get to the next level. And you realize once you're at blue, it's just, you're still a beginner. Like, I'm still a beginner. And I don't know if it's that or if it's just maybe the level. I just haven't been as consistent lately. So let's start the whole podcast over.
Are there other things that have replaced jiu-jitsu in the last few months for yourself?
Definitely. I've gotten back into comic books a lot. Mm-hmm. So I've also been doing more yoga. I feel like I just feel less aggressive lately, you know. But, you know.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I don't necessarily feel like getting hurt as much.
Oh, that's a fair assessment.
So how about you? What about you?
What about me?
Yeah, what about your jiu-jitsu career?
I'm at a point where I very much need a motivation to go. I think you are much more likely to just do things on your own and push yourself. I need that extra motivation.
But so are you. I mean, all these shows that you do, nobody's forcing you to do them. Nobody's forcing you.
Oh, there's certain things. When it comes to like going to jiu-jitsu, going to work out, I really need a bigger motivation.
Motivation is like the main thing, really is. I think,
like working out. I've got a gym at my place, and I'll go occasionally.
Yeah.
But it's boring. Like, yeah. I don't get any enjoyment. Some people love working out because they feel great after. And I do feel great. Whenever I work out afterwards, you always feel great. Mm-hmm. But the actual process of knowing that at the end of the day you're going to do this, and then the actual process of, like, getting on to a treadmill and running and lifting heavy things, it's just like, this is so boring to
me. Yeah, it sucks.
Like, I can put a podcast on, I can listen to music, but it's like... All my head is doing is thinking of all the other things I could be doing that are more productive than this.
But, you know, I think a lot of people would say that doing, you know, watching Raw is really boring. But why do you watch Raw?
I mean, because everything I watch, fighting or wrestling related, there's a reason for it. There's an end product that I'm going to... We're going to do a show at the end of this. Like, I would not be sitting back in the middle of the summer, and I've got free time, and I'm going to pop in a disc of ROH Final Battle 2010 for shits.
You might watch, you know, a couple matches on it, but you probably wouldn't watch the whole 3-hour thing.
No.
Exactly.
I need to know that there's something at the end of it. I don't think there's no way I would sit through and watch Raw every Monday night if I didn't do the law and we didn't do a show right after.
Yeah, because
there's no way.
Because you know you'll be doing a podcast and you know you'll be releasing that podcast to an audience and you'll hear feedback from that audience about you know putting that time in. And I'm sure it's the same with working out. Maybe, you know, you have a big swimsuit competition coming up and that might be some motivation.
Are you reading my notes?
That would be motivation for you to get in there and work out. I mean, I'm sure it kind of sucks, but you know, same with any type of training. You look forward to the end result so much that it becomes not.
That was kind of my thought process of that. I feel when I was doing jiu-jitsu much more regularly, I thought I should just enter into a jiu-jitsu competition because it will give me something that I don't want to be terrible at this. So I will have a reason to work for all this. I'm sure it's very much for like any fighter that when you have a fight scheduled, that's going to get you out of bed every morning and that's going to get you to the gym because the other guy's training to beat you.
100%. And I'll say, like, you know, when I was like white belt, a big help for me was goal setting. And that's something that our professor at OpenMat, Elliot Baev, is a very strong proponent of. Just, you know, not just in jiu-jitsu, but in life, to at the beginning of the year or at any time in the year, you know, there are New Year's resolutions. But then, like, there are you can make goals, but then you can also, like, really try to sit down and write them out and actually plan them out. And he was really, you know, helpful with that. And I don't know. Maybe that's something I need right now. Maybe that's something that would help you. But you really don't seem like somebody who needs help with motivation in other areas of your life. You know what I mean? Like you're very much a self-motivator, I'd say. Like when it comes to, especially when it comes to work, you know?
Like Final Battle. I watched this thing in one sitting this past week.
That's crazy.
How long did it take you to watch this?
A few days ago, yeah. But it did take me pretty much over the span of like maybe 3-4 sessions in 24 hours.
Wow.
Yeah, I broke it up into pieces.
See, there's a certain correlation here between yourself and the booking of the main event with the idea that Kevin Steen was going to go away for a long time because of the idea that you go away and you're away from the crowd and the public and then you come back and people have missed you and it's kind of like your jiu-jitsu. You need to go away and then you're going to redevelop that desire. And then jiu-jitsu is going to come back.
Perhaps.
In a big way.
Yeah. Yeah. Perhaps.
So definitely. I can clearly see why you chose Final Battle 2010.
This Dan Levransky suggested a Ring of Honor show, and Final Battle just seemed the most accessible for our audience, I'd say.
Yes. I was overwhelmed at the start because in my head, this was a 4-hour show. And I was like, how in God's name am I going to watch this week? So I sat down on Tuesday. And I just ran through the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I'm not going to have any other day this week to watch this show.
Wow.
Powered through it.
There you go. That's motivation.
Yeah, what motivation? I sat on my couch and took notes for 3.5 hours. Later on in the show, you heard Jim Cornette on The Law Sunday night. I also chatted with him about this particular show because Jim Cornette, of course, was booking alongside Hunter Johnston at this particular time period. And this was... Of course, it's the big year-end show for Ring of Honor, and this was at a point where they had not yet been sold to Sinclair, but the negotiations had already started. They knew they were about to be taken off of HDNet, which was their weekly television show at the time. And so a lot of things in motion. They were culminating, or at least taking the Steen-Generico feud. This had been a year-long feud, a very successful program involving the two, as well as Steve Corino and Colt Cabana, and this was supposed to be a major blow-off to this feud with major consequences with the mask versus Steen's career in ROH. And as well, just a lot of talent on this show that has moved on to NXT, to the WWE, mm-hmm. and interesting to see where they all were in 2010. Were you watching any Ring of Honor at this point? Because HDNet, not that accessible in Canada at that particular time.
No, I really wasn't at this time.
So watching this, we started things off with this this very ominous video package and the New York skyline as part of the graphics package. What did you think of the graphics here, Wei?
I didn't think that much of it, you know. Certainly a step up from previous Ring of Honor releases. I mean, I remember watching a lot of it from the mid-2000s, sort of the glory period with Joe and Punk and all those
guys. How
was
the white balancing on this show?
It was perfect. Looked great. But, you know, obviously, Ring of Honor is, at least started off as largely just a home video production company and not, you know, not necessarily a company with broadcast professionals attached to its production. And certainly with the HDNet Association, that's when I think you started to notice some changes in the production, including some of these packages, which, I don't know if it, some of them seem to be done by the HDNet crew. You know, you could tell, like, there's a certain level of production there that was different. But the cameras and certainly the audio on this show, a lot of it seemed to still be done by, you know, the Ring of Honor crew, which is, they're way better now, but still in this 2010 period, there's a lot to be desired in terms of production.
The best part about these iPay-per-views, they had gotten into working with Go Fight Live a year prior to this at the Final Battle 2009 show. So they had done, there was a Big Bang show in April, and then this show, it did just under about 2,000 buys on Go Fight Live. So we're not talking monstrous business they were doing. You're obviously sharing with Go Fight Live, but the margin for to become profitable on an iPay-per-view, it was very small. I mean, they only had to do a couple hundred buys to break even. Very low risk in terms of production costs, but also you're splitting it with Go Fight Live. They were notorious, of course, for just tons of technical issues and problems throughout this entire period.
It honestly is like a very ambitious task to do a live show, even though it is live streaming, which with the crew of, I'm assuming, you know, not like a very low budget, first of all, and I'm assuming a crew that's not very large, you know, on the production side of things. I mean, we've seen, you know, what really, like in the Toronto shows, we've seen them do these shows, and it's like, honestly, it looks like a table and maybe like three, four guys trying to put this whole show together.
And some of the, like one of the Toronto shows they had here, it was an iPay-per-view, and I mean, they lost the feed because someone tripped over a cord.
Oh.
You know what I mean? Just like stories like that that you can't help but laugh about.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it was one problem after the other with both Go Fight Live, when they took it in-house, and it was just – it got to a point where they just – the iPay-per-views, they just kind of got rid of them. They still do now – they do iPay-per-views, but, I mean, they – they've really kind of harnessed their bets because the technical problems, I mean, they became synonymous with ROH iPay-per-views.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a problem where the industry that they're in sort of demands live shows and live pay-per-views, but Ring of Honor, especially at the time, was really not in a position to be able to deliver that, you know, on the budget that they had.
One of the better parts of these iPay-per-views was the fact that it wasn't HDNet putting their people...
Yes.
So the announce crew was Kevin Kelly and Dave Prazak, as opposed to the TV duo of Mike Hogwood, who would do commentary with Dave Prazak. And I enjoy Dave Prazak. Mike Hogwood was... he was horrendous.
Yeah, from what little I saw of the show, I mean, what was he, like some type of... like, what was his day
job?
He
was just a guy who had a broadcasting background that was put into wrestling.
Knew nothing about pro wrestling.
He knew nothing. Yes. He was someone that had to be heavily produced. And, I mean, he couldn't have called this three-plus-hour show without just, I think, exposing himself to a terrible degree and putting this guy in a live environment.
I like, you know, Kevin Kelly and Dave Prazak a lot on this show, but... from what I could hear of them, because the audio mix on this thing was just atrocious.
It started off with the All Night Express, Kenny King and Rhett Titus coming out with a pair of women to take on the team of Future Shock, Adam Cole and Kyle O'Reilly, who have now ascended to become main talent with not only with Ring of Honor, but Kyle O'Reilly now a regular in New Japan Pro Wrestling. Adam Cole has also gone over there. And now, of course, you see Kenny King still with TNA and Rhett Titus of all of them. I know they had a lot of high hopes for this guy. He just kind of does this comedy character under a mask now as the romantic touch in Ring of Honor. So it's interesting to go back to this particular time period. And throughout this show, Wei, it really emphasized what an incredible tag division they had in 2010. Like, this was a promotion that could have been built around the tag division because of the various teams they had. And Cole and O'Reilly were like the young up-and-comers that had come into the promotion. And, I mean, they branched into becoming big stars themselves.
It really just seems like, you know, the talent scouting in Ring of Honor is so good that you could really feel like, you could put anybody on the roster together and you can come up with a really good team.
Timing-wise as well, Tyler Black had been a major part of Ring of Honor over this past year, and it was just a few months before Final Battle that he signed his developmental deal with the WWE. So he had left, but he had been a major part of Ring of Honor for the past year plus at this point as their heavyweight champion. So the match begins, and Kenny King grabs his balls before offering his hand, and Kyle O'Reilly shakes it. I guess he's cool. Whatever.
Sure.
That's the All Night Express hand gesture. They note this is Future Shock's first match ever at the Manhattan Center in New York City. O'Reilly goes for an armbar attempt early on Titus, and lots of leg kicks in here. The All Night Express, they catch O'Reilly and Cole with a suicide dive, and then there's a double dragon screw by O'Reilly to both members of the All Night Express, making the tag to Cole. Cole springs over the top to a DDT to King on the apron. That gets a big reaction, and then there's a running missile dropkick by O'Reilly off the apron to Kenny King against the barricade. They come back. They're double-teaming Cole, running knees to the back, near fall on Cole. And the end sees O'Reilly sent to the floor and a blockbuster into a Titus powerbomb, and they pin Adam Cole 9 minutes, 24 seconds, and Rhett Titus just mauls one of the women afterwards and carries her to the back to do God knows what.
Probably
he was going to go all night.
Or he probably just kind of set her down and then...
This was not the romantic touch. This was the romantic attack.
Ah, okay. Well, a very good opener. I think both teams are really just awesome. You know, working a style that I think has really now finally started to become very popular in the mainstream, in the WWE, just that kind of cruiserweight X division style. And they did that very well here. I did think that, you know, for an opening match, there's maybe too many near falls. Like the fact that this kind of... I thought the match maybe peaked in excitement maybe about 2 minutes before it actually ended. You know, everything that kind of took place after that point was just maybe a little necessary, but still a very good match.
Yes, I thought so too. And that was kind of the change in philosophy of Ring of Honor. In 2008, that's when they replaced Gabe Sapolsky with Adam Pearce. And the idea was, you know, there was going to be a shift going from what everyone had expected of a Ring of Honor, which was you go out, you do your four-hour show, you let everybody just go to the limit.
Everybody's trying to steal the show.
And with this, with the time period here where it was Jim Cornette, it was Delirious, it was Adam Pearce, the idea, and you could see from this undercard, I mean, they kept these undercard matches to about 10 minutes or so. And I think they were trying to, you still want to satisfy your hardcore ROH base, but at the same time, instead of booking 8 matches that were just, you can go out doing whatever, yeah, we're trying to book one whole show from start to finish. And there's different arguments to both philosophies, but you could see, and this upset a lot of ROH fans, that they were trying to change what they loved about Ring of Honor, but they were also trying to grow because they had seen what the limit was of the old regime under Gabe.
Mm-hmm.
TJ Perkins and Colt Cabana were next in a scientific showdown.
Mm-hmm.
This was something. Just put that on the marquee. The scientific showdown.
They came out with beakers and goggles.
Yes, yes. What was the formula to success for these two men?
Mm-hmm.
The answer, not becoming manic in TNA, as TJ Perkins has ascended to. These two, actually, in a trivia note, had a TNA dark match just 3 months before this particular match.
Oh. Was it scientific?
It's unconfirmed.
Okay.
But it did
a dark matter match.
A dark matter match.
Yeah.
That might be the Stardust Green Arrow match at SummerSlam.
Are you sure you don't want to start this podcast over?
I thought we did already.
Okay.
Cabana is just playing around with Perkins. They noted here, Cabana has a slightly torn hamstring because the back of his right leg has tape all over it.
Oh, wow.
So that's a bitch.
It was slightly torn, and I guess all the better reason for a match like this, because, you know, I thought this was a very good contrast to the first match that we saw. It was much more technical and, you know, slower, more subtle, and more intricate.
It was a John McDessie match.
How so?
Very technical.
Technical.
Yeah. There's a head scissors takeover by Perkins. A lot of comedy from Cabana trying to escape, putting his crotch in the face of TJ and teasing him with these kick attempts. Cabana applies the Billy Goat's curse, and Perkins gets to the rope right away. There's an exchange of strikes. Cabana hit a big elbow to the head, and then the Billy Goat's curse is reversed with a roll-up. Cabana kicks out and then uses a sunset flip roll-up to catch Perkins and get the win at 7 minutes and 55 seconds. We don't have to get into all of it. Certainly, Colt Cabana and Jim Cornette have very much voiced, you know, these two were very much at odds. Jim Cornette was not a big fan of Cabana's style and the comedy. I feel that having different styles throughout your undercard are a huge benefit, and I think having a match like this totally has its place.
Definitely.
I don't want to see, you know, an ROH card where it's like 9 matches and they're all booked very similar, where it's the crazy athletic style, big near fall. I don't want to see 4 hours of that. I want to see my comedy match. I want to see my old school tag match. You want as much variety as possible.
Yeah. You turn on Netflix and, you know, you can watch 10 action movies in a row, but by that time, I'm kind of in the mood for a documentary, or I'm kind of in the mood for a comedy. And it's the same with pro wrestling. The thing is, like, pro wrestling, there's so many different styles of it. And I think the strength of a guy like Colt is that he's versatile enough to be able to do many different styles. And one of the ones he happens to excel in is comedy. But in this case, it was just more of like a sort of like almost a European, you know, ground-based kind of chain wrestling style. And I thought he and TJ Perkins here were both very impressive here. I like this match a lot.
They may say funny doesn't draw money, but funny can be the honey on top.
Okay.
Reset.
I'm looking at this stop button here very closely.
I want us to have the worst show of all time today. Daisy Hayes is talking about getting into wrestling due to the lack of respect that women wrestling has received. What a tie-in to today's Divas Revolution.
And this was
2010.
I mean, yeah, you know, but for all the praise these NXT girls are getting right now, I mean, look no further than, you know, Shimmer or ROH in the 2000s, and you could see, you know, the level of women to work in North America has been at a high level, or at least at that level, you know, for a number of years.
Her and Sarah Del Rey, who is one of the main agents now, she's up on the main roster, has worked extensively with the women throughout NXT and on the main roster. Their feud is simply over who is the best. And Del Rey, I thought her part in this video was just great. She's just like, it's just subtle. She's like, I don't really consider it a rivalry when she's got me a few times when I've been less than 100%, and just almost laughs off this girl as being her equal. And I thought the sit-down portion here was better than anything we've seen from the Divas on the main roster so far. This was just like, it's a personal grudge, and one thinks she's better than the other.
I found like the sit-down interview format to be pretty effective, you know, in not just here, but like you think about like some of the Brock Lesnar build-ups that we've seen recently in the WWE. It almost feels like a more, I don't know, a natural environment for people to kind of get their storylines across, rather than just somebody delivering a promo in front of a camera by themselves. Like, answering questions seems like a format that's not really utilized enough.
So the match is Sarah Del Rey and Serena Deeb, who was just on Impact recently and has actually just retired over the past month.
She was recently let go by the WWE.
You're right. She had just been let go by the WWE, where she was part of the Straight Edge Society, with the explanation that her actions were not consistent with the character. So I guess not acting straight edge.
What exactly was the reason why she was let go?
I believe there was some incident on a European tour, and they never really got into specific details, but was let go as a result of it.
They come out to, or Del Rey comes out at this point to Ride of the Valkyries, which
prior to Daniel Bryan doing.
Yeah, and it's a weird story. I checked out an interview with her where she talked about it, and it was about how she also used to come out to the Final Countdown too, which was also Daniel Bryan's theme song, because it was originally a suggestion from Daniel Bryan that she come out to it. So then Bryan says, "Hey, remember that suggestion I gave you? I'm gonna take it back." So then Bryan starts using it. And then, so Bryan instead suggests for her to use the Ride of the Valkyries. And then Bryan goes to the WWE.
Remember that replacement to my original suggestion? I'm taking that one too.
Yeah.
I'm going to come out to Flight of the Valkyries. And then at the end, when I win a match, I want to go out to the Final Countdown.
Exactly.
So how about you come out to an instrumental version?
Yeah. So this girl can't win. She should just really stop taking music suggestions.
Oh, she gave up her career as a result of this. Like, I can't keep up with this guy.
Yeah.
So Daisy Hayes, her partner was not awesome. Amazing Kong, mm-hmm. for legal purposes. Had been after she had left TNA earlier in the year, in the fallout of everything with Bubba the Love Sponge and
a different fallout.
Yes. So
with Bubba the Love Sponge.
A different fallout. The match begins. Hayes is dressed like a mini version of Kong.
Oh, she looked great. Yeah.
And the crowd begins with a chant of "Fuck the Divas." Hayes hits a Hurricane Rana off the top to Del Rey. And then Deeb stops Hayes from tagging Kong in. Deeb is in and they start chanting CM Punk at her. CM Punk at this point, this was during the period where he was doing commentary when he was hurt on Raw, and he was popping up on TV with, you know, a Colt Cabana t-shirt, Kevin Steen shirt, and just, I think, really endearing himself with all those inside references during that commentary period where, you know, he was hurt, but that was, to me, a significant part of his WWE career, was just excelling in that color role.
It felt like that shift, you know, where he just kind of stopped caring so much. Not to say, like, stopped caring so much that he didn't perform to his best ability, but he didn't care so much about, you know, management.
It's what they call the fuck it factor in performance, where you just go out. And you're not afraid of failing.
Mm-hmm. Or getting fired.
Yeah. They isolate Hayes in their corner. They tag in. Dave Prazak, ever the promoter, plugs their work for Shimmer, noting if you go pick up Shimmer Volume 22 involving Hayes and Serena Deeb, you can see more of their back history.
Cool.
Hayes hits applies a roll-up as referee Paul Turner is distracted with Kong. Then Hayes is placed in the tree of Joey Lawrence. Great.
What's the reference there?
Whoa.
Oh.
Joey Lawrence's phrase.
Oh, brilliant.
It's his word.
Brilliant.
I loved it. Splash to Del Rey for a two count. Then the amazing bomb is blocked, hits a lariat to Del Rey. Kong was just so over to this crowd. They loved her here. Swung Sarah into an implant buster and got a two count. Then there's a heart punch, a spinning back fist, a Yakuza kick, and leg drop delivered to Deeb. And Kong goes down from a capo kick. Hayes is in, kicks out of the Royal Butterfly from Del Rey. And then Deeb spears Kong. There's a pile driver delivered to Hayes, and Del Rey pins her at 8 minutes and 18 seconds. And Deeb was selling her left shoulder from the spear spot and looked to be in legitimate pain from this shoulder injury. And then Del Rey just grabs her left arm and holds it up. We won! As Serena Deeb looked like she was her shoulder was in deep shit.
Very good. Very good.
Just stop it. Let's just end. Yeah. And Kong piggybacked Hayes to the back.
I thought the match was okay, you know. I feel like I've seen better, and that's because I feel like I hold these girls to probably a higher standard than, you know, a typical Divas match, for instance. But I really liked up until this point the variety on the show. I mean, we had three matches, but three very different matches, and I like that a lot.
Sanjay Dutt taking on Eddie Edwards, who was extremely over to this crowd. Edwards had recently injured his shoulder really badly on a show, and he gutted his way through the match. And that was a significant match for Eddie Edwards because it really kind of – it was, you know, to a smaller degree, kind of how Triple H is linked to that torn quad of a guy gutting his way through a nasty injury and finishing the match. Dutt here, speaking of injuries, had his lower spine taped. So who knows what was going on with the injuries here, but never fun when you
spine
see
tape.
Spine tape.
Spinal tape.
Oh my God.
Okay, I'm gonna stop this.
Rising to new lows. Edwards, his right shoulder taped up from the aforementioned injury at the Survival of the Fittest show. Sanjay slapped Edwards and then crawls under the ring and comes up from behind and turns and takes a chop from Edwards.
That was a little out of place, I thought. Like, all of a sudden, you know, this was it seemed like a pretty serious match between these two, and then he just kind of goes hornswoggle for like a little comedy spot here.
They fought on the floor, and they just go around the barricade. Dutt gets seated on the top rope, and Edwards hits a springboard Hurricane Rana and then kicks Dutt right in the chest, rolls out of a camel clutch attempt, and then applies a half crab. Dutt counters with a cradle for a two count. Dutt then hit a springboard splash and a series of two counts that he had on Edwards. There was a standing sliced bread, which is Tetsuya Naito's new finish that he's introduced in the G1.
Which is also kind of Eva Marie's new finish, too.
It all is linked. Tetsuya Naito to Eva Marie,
yeah,
with a bridge of Sanjay Dutt and Brian Kendrick.
Mm-hmm.
It's all many, many slices of bread in the pro wrestling
like a
diet.
Whole, it's a loaf. That's their faction name. The loaf. This is the worst show. Are you sure we should get Jordan,
we're not even releasing this one.
Jordan Breen back here.
If I just put, do you think if I took a review from like 2010 and just put it up on a Wednesday, how many would notice? Like Brad would notice?
Yeah, for sure. I think a few people would notice. If we would just have to like maybe change some of the references.
There would be the issue of saying what we were going to be reviewing ahead of time and
yeah,
reviewing
something. I feel like we could probably try that maybe like 10 years in. Maybe 10 years in we could.
Okay,
we could
we're like halfway there.
Yeah.
We're more than halfway there at this point.
Yeah.
What year is this coming up on? This is started
six.
This, 09. Six.
Yeah.
Holy
it's
Christ.
Crazy. Yeah, it's a long time.
What are we going to review for that?
Something from that year, I bet. That was current that year, perhaps.
Where were we here? The loaf. He catches Edwards for a tombstone. That's blocked. And then there's a handstand by Dutt, but then gets kicked in the chest by Edwards, who comes back. It's a code breaker off the turnbuckle. There's an exchange of super kicks, a rotating lariat to Dutt. And then Dutt is knocked off the top, and Eddie Edwards hits a double foot stomp to the back, to the spinal tap, and hits the 2K1, which is basically a cradle shock slam, and pins Dutt clean at 10 minutes and 44 seconds.
I thought the match was very good, very fast, very technical. You know, the most technical match, I think, up until this point. Basically the complete opposite of some of the matches I watched last week on SummerSlam 88. You know, this was...
What a contrast for you.
This
going
was,
from
yeah,
Hercules...
Ken Patera and Bad News Brown to this... you know, but to be honest, like I already found myself getting a little tired even up until this point. And this was only the fourth match, but I felt like I had seen so much already. You know?
And this right across the street from where SummerSlam 88 took place, Madison Square Garden.
Wow. Okay.
Just right around the corner.
Yep.
There was a recap of the Kings of Wrestling and, wrestling's greatest tag team for legal purposes. From that past September, and Charlie Haas and Shelton Benjamin raving about how this match brought back their passion to this industry. And Jim Cornette has this taped sit-down with wrestling's greatest tag team. Actually, they were seated. Cornette was standing. From Louisville prior to Final Battle. And Benjamin goes over his athletic background, training Brock Lesnar in university and then starting in OVW. And then Haas describes his background in Oklahoma, and they announced that in 2011 they are joining Ring of Honor on a regular basis. They want the tag titles, and they zoom out at the end to reveal the boom mic. ROH. ROH.
This segment I actually enjoyed a lot too, much like how, you know, the sit down interviews used to promote the women's match. I enjoyed. I think this type of setting worked really well for this team as well, because you're trying to get over this, you know, the shooter gimmick, which a lot of teams in ROH seem to have. But ROH, I think, you know, is still based more in sort of a reality. And guys like this team, and let's be honest, Haas and Benjamin aren't the best promo in the world. You know what I mean?
No.
Or in wrestling.
No.
Or for legal purposes. But, you know, in this type of setting, I think they come across a lot better, like legit athletes, not necessarily cutting trash talking promos, but talking like actual athletes.
Yes. And the passion for Charlie Haas would be somewhat limited before he would outright leave the industry.
Hmm.
So Shelton Benjamin, though, still kicking it at Pro Wrestling Noah with Suzuki Gun. Mike Bennett comes out with brutal Bob Evans to chants of "Who are you?" as he sat ringside to watch this next match. Now, there's an interesting connection here between Ring of Honor at this time period, and I think something that Ring of Honor is always going to have to deal with, and NXT, in that their audience that they have cultivated, they are accustomed to seeing some of the best wrestling in the world, whether it be the main events at NXT and some of the standout performers that have come in there, your Balors, your Joes, et cetera, et cetera. And here in Ring of Honor, where you are also accustomed to seeing some of the best talent in the world. At the same time, you have to be bringing in younger talent and developing them. And Michael Bennett totally fell into this role in 2010, where no one believed this guy was at the high standard that Ring of Honor had created. And now we're seeing in NXT, when you're trying to bring in Dana Brooke and bring her up, who is less than a year into her career, Baron Corbin, Mojo Rawley, you're trying to develop younger talent in front of fans that are expecting the best wrestling in the world. And that becomes very difficult on your fan base. And it was something Ring of Honor was going through. And it's such a high standard of who we are going to accept in these promotions.
So how did this guy, Mike Bennett, overcome that?
I mean, to a degree, he's never fully gotten through that. But, I mean, his best role has been in a tag team with Matt Taven. He's gone over to New Japan. But especially when he was a single star, it was the idea, like, this guy cannot hang with the top talent. And I think Michael Bennett, there's a lot of I thought some of the criticism was too harsh on this guy. But he's also being compared to a who's who of independent wrestling in Ring of Honor throughout these last 5 years.
Well, there's an argument that, you know, you could say that it's beneficial for guys like this to be around more established people just because it rises up the entire level of the roster. I think, you know, you can get to a point, though, like we might see in NXT now where the discrepancy is a little too much. But I do wonder if in the end it'll benefit guys, you know, just starting out to be around talent like that.
So the matchup, we had a non-title match involving television champion Christopher Daniels and Homicide.
In what they billed as a Legends match.
A Legends match.
Like a Ring of Honor Legends match.
And this also featured the return of Julius Smokes, who had been gone for a long time. One of the more underrated personalities in Ring of Honor history.
Yeah he's great. And
I mean, the facial expressions of Julius Smokes, top drawer, in my opinion. I always enjoyed Julius Smokes.
Yep.
So he's out with Homicide. Daniels had just won the title from Eddie Edwards the week prior.
What title was that?
The television title.
Okay, but it wasn't on the line, obviously.
No, this was a non-title match. Okay. I guess because the match was signed before Daniels had won the title.
Well, okay, that's interesting. And I guess we'll talk about it in the finish.
Both Daniels and Homicide, notable they were on the very first ROH card in February of 2002. The crowd starts with a "fuck TNA" chant. Of course, this had been Daniels had been let go earlier that year at the end of March of 2010. But Daniels ended up turning it into an ROH chant, pointing down to the logo on the mat. I mean, a talented worker here.
This was the same thing that happened
with
last
Bully
week.
Ray? Yes.
With Bully Ray. And I'm sure this happens a lot where, you know, a former or even he was a current TNA guy at the time, and people were chanting "fuck TNA" at the House of Hardcore show. And
he was the authority figure.
Yeah. And it was like the exact same thing where Bully Ray told the crowd to stop chanting "fuck TNA." And, you know, it's obviously these people still know many friends there, and I think
5 years apart, and yet the same image for TNA amongst their crowd. And believe me, TNA was not always the redheaded stepchild.
No,
for independent wrestling fans. I mean, up until I will say 2006, you know, from 2002 to 2006, I will say TNA. There was a time you could hear TNA chants during Raw. During horrible segments. Go back and watch the Donald Trump, Rosie O'Donnell segment on Raw. People start chanting TNA in protest. Could you fathom that happening today?
No.
Today, Now TNA, last week on Impact, Tigre Uno is challenging Donald Trump to come to the Impact Zone. They're redoing shitty WWE ideas.
Wow.
From 2007. Anyway, back to our Legends match. Daniels and Homicide. The crowd does start chanting ROH. They fought on the floor. Daniels gets his neck snapped on the top rope, but then hits a split-legged moonsault to the floor. Homicide gets the advantage, hits a Tope Con Hilo as Julius Smokes is just going nuts celebrating this Tope Con Hilo hitting. There's a curb stomp to the chest off the second turnbuckle by Daniels. Then Homicide shoves Daniels off the turnbuckle and hits a jumping knee to the back of the neck and continues to work on the neck of Daniels. There's a Uranagi and a missed best moonsault ever. And then the Angel's Wings is blocked by Homicide. He's driven into referee Paul Turner. And then Homicide gets a t-shirt and throws the t-shirt at Christopher Daniels. And this blurs his vision and he's distracted. And Homicide hits the Ace Crusher and pins Daniels at 10 minutes and 32 seconds. And Daniels is upset with Paul Turner after the match. I thought a pretty lame finish.
Mm.
I'd say the worst on the show.
The t-shirt throwing?
The t-shirt, like...
In the eye?
If I threw a t-shirt at you, I don't think you would be stunned to such a degree that I could hit a debilitating maneuver on you.
If you're fast enough, you might be able to. Like, I try to imagine if a dude in the UFC, you know...
What kind of reflexes do you have if I threw a t-shirt at you and you couldn't just swat it away in midair? Like, are you really going to stand there as it hits you in the head and then you're... Shaking your... Oh, my God. 100% cotton.
Have you ever been in a wrestling match, John?
In a wrestling match?
Yeah,
no, I haven't.
So then you don't know what all the variables there are.
Like, couldn't they have put, like, a brick inside the shirt?
Well,
something concrete.
Okay.
Maybe, to emphasize.
Maybe he forgot to use fabric softener, and it was a really rough shirt.
Could have been.
All right. Hey, the match...
It was fine.
The match was, yeah, it was all right. I think what's notable is just how, you know, they build this as a Legends match, and this crowd certainly treated these two like it. And I also think it's really cool how, you know, you can argue that these two probably have the most name value in terms of national TV exposure of anybody else on the roster. And I really liked how traditionally ROH has always not necessarily put the biggest name guys at the top of the card. But, you know, kind of stack them in the middle and let the current crop of people in the main event shine. And this was no different. I mean, that was sort of the trend going all the way back to the first ROH show where they had Eddie Guerrero on that show, but
right.
he didn't main event. In fact, it was Daniels and, Bryan Danielson and,
Loki
in that main event. So a similar thing here.
Afterwards, Bennett tosses the television title to Daniels and mocks him. And Bennett was just chewing this bubble gum to such an annoying degree. I thought he was going to get lockjaw from this.
So, yeah, Daniels is a champ, but he loses via t-shirt distraction.
Oh. Who knows what the...
Yeah, it's only the TV belt.
Well, right? I guess it could have been the t-shirt belt. There's a video for the six man involving a J-driller delivered to Sarah Del Rey. And the quote, "Oh, my God! Right in the crotch!" by Mike Hogwood. A Hogwood classic. As Hagedorn low blows Jay during the video. Right in the crotch! So our six-man tag, the Kings of Wrestling, Claudio Castagnoli and Chris Hero, alongside Shane Hagedorn against the Briscoe Brothers and Papa Mike Briscoe.
Mm-hmm. I had heard a lot about a lot of rave reviews of Papa Mike Briscoe at the time, but never really sought out to watch it. So this is my
this
first
guy
exposure.
Goes to all of the Briscoes' major matches. Remember that one year at WrestleMania
in New York,
the night
right
Jay won the title,
right here in the same.
You're right,
building.
Same building where we sat behind not just Papa Briscoe, the entire Briscoe family.
Yeah.
Like, there was, like, an entire row of them,
mm-hmm.
all excited. And all night long, we were like, he's got to be doing some kind of a run-in. But he didn't.
Right.
He was just there to watch.
No.
Talk about timely here.
Yeah.
The Briscoes all out in their Confederate flag attire.
Certainly timely now. And how have they changed? How have they changed it? How have they addressed that?
Well, they haven't been wearing the... I mean, they have merchandise that's had the Confederate
flag. It's part
flag
of their
on.
Logo. It's part of their identity, like their entire ROH identity. I mean, the guy had a belt with a Confederate flag on it when he was champion.
Yeah,
so,
well...
Certainly, you know, in 2010.
Different time period. This was only like a few years ago.
But I mean, recent events have certainly, you know, made that flag much more taboo. And you know, rightfully so, I think. But at this time, I don't think, you know, nobody really thought. It was probably controversial even at this time, too, but probably not to the extent. I mean, you know. Jamie Noble had that flag. Bully Ray had that flag, you know, for a number of years.
The Southern Boys.
Yeah.
Let's review Clash of the Champions.
A lot of people have had that flag. But, you know, at this point right now, I think, you know, it should probably be something that shouldn't be brought up.
Papa Briscoe continually referred to Shane Hagedorn as Peckerhead. And Papa gets on the mic thanking all of New York for supporting his sons all of these years. The crowd was chanting, "This is awesome," before the bell even rung. And the Kings of Wrestling, who were the tag champions at this point, got the early advantage on Jay. Hagedorn would then come in with uppercuts, which Jay no-sold, and then kicked him in the head. They finally tagged in Papa Briscoe, who came and stomped Hagedorn, and then he tags in Claudio. And
this guy's in, like, really good shape for his age. I don't know how old he is, but, like, he certainly looks like he worked out.
Well, this was an ambitious decision on the ROH side to put this kind of a match together, because you could tell the crowd they enjoyed Papa Briscoe, but when you're putting him in a match, they seemed somewhat hesitant about this guy actually being in a match.
Especially in ROH.
Especially.
It seems like a very WWE type of move.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He was given this one big spot of doing this tilt-a-whirl head scissors, yeah. And the crowd instantly got into him at that point. But certainly, you can't say that Papa Briscoe and Shane Hagedorn improved this match, and I think that's where some of the reluctance was.
Not in terms of the match quality, but in terms of the excitement, I'd say they probably did.
This was built up for quite a while, so yeah. The idea here was, you know, this is...
And he didn't look like a fool out there. Like,
no.
He looked actually somewhat impressive, you know? And you can't doubt this man's natural charisma, you know, ring work aside.
There was a point where the crowd actually booed Papa Briscoe running in and breaking up this submission that Chris Hero had applied. Hero misses the rolling elbow to Mark and then nails Claudio. Mark then tags in Jay. Hero hits a big boot to Jay, and then Claudio presses Jay in the air for an uppercut but misses him. Everyone gets laid out. Hagedorn low blows Jay, and then Papa attacks Hagedorn and sends him to the floor. Briscoe's hit somersault dives to Claudio and Hero on the floor, and then Papa calls for a dive, but Hagedorn trips him.
That was really nice. Was
we missed
really,
the, really,
he doesn't just call for a dive. He calls for some type of spinning move in the air that he was going to do.
Time for some spinning shit.
Yeah.
The Papa Con Hilo. There was another rolling elbow by Hero to Papa, and the crowd starts chanting for Hero here, and they tease the KRS-One. Jay stops them. Papa Briscoe hits a stunner, and then Hagedorn is placed on the shoulders of Jay, and Papa Briscoe comes off the top for a doomsday device, and Hagedorn just rotates in midair, and Jay pins Hagedorn at 15 minutes and 50 seconds. How mm-hmm. did this go?
I thought this was fun. I thought the match was a lot of fun. I mean, I really don't think that the two, you know, Papa Briscoe really hurt the match. I really do think he added a lot to the excitement level of this crowd. This crowd was really into this match the whole time, you know, and they just gave them what they wanted to see, and that's this guy Papa Briscoe kicking ass.
And again, I go back to the tag division, and you just look at, you know, the Kings of Wrestling, the Briscoes. You had your Next Generation with Future Shock. The All Night Express were certainly coming up. Mm-hmm. You had some great tag teams at this particular time. Benjamin and Haas were now going to be doing regular dates with ROH. It was a really strong tag core that they had in Ring of Honor at this time. Roderick Strong, joined by Truth Martini, the ROH champion, defending against Davey Richards. And this was our first of two marathon matches to close out the show. Richards offers his hand, and Roderick refuses to shake hands to start this off. We're not going to go through everything here because there was just so much. Was there too much in this match, Way? That seems to be the debate. You either loved this or you thought it was overkill.
Well, I do think that there was too much in that opening match. This was a match where I felt like too much wasn't really as much of a problem because this was, you know, the seconds from the top. And I feel like it's one of the matches... Although I will say it did kind of hurt the main event for me. you know, the fact that, so much was done in this. But I like this match a lot.
Yeah, I mean, these two tremendous, tremendous performers. One of the first major key spots was that insane, like super Tope Con Hilo that Richards hit, and just the velocity, the speed at which he rotated and then landed in the crowd.
Yeah, that was
awesome.
He
could have just taken someone out cold. No. I mean, it was just insane the speed at which he was going here. Crowd was, I mean, just in love with Davey Richards.
Oh,
they
yeah.
were so ready for this guy to win this title. Strong got pressed in the air, and Richards just nailed him with a kick to the chest, diving headbutt off the top, and then a Falcon Arrow right into an armbar. And you can certainly see the influence of Davey Richards and, of course, his association with Kyle O'Reilly. And this was a period where they were very much trying to take their jiu-jitsu training and mm-hmm. work it into pro wrestling. And I think that Davey Richards was someone who did it very well.
He did, definitely. Like, I really noted here how I think so often you see people try to incorporate, you know, MMA or legit moves into the pro wrestling. And often, like, if you watch MMA, you watch the pro wrestling version of it, and it just looks very terribly weak. But I thought, like, Davey Richards here, one of the more convincing people to make that style work effectively. Like, his kicks look very good. His technique with a lot of his submissions look very technically sound. So he really does come across as a guy who, you know, even though he's a pro wrestler, if he really wanted to hurt you, you know that he could.
There was a kick to the head for a two count, and then Richards applies the ankle lock. Truth Martini gets on the apron, and Todd Sinclair gets distracted with Martini as Roderick is tapping, but the referee doesn't see it. Richards then hit a shooting star press for a near fall that the crowd completely bought as the finish after mm-hmm. Strong had done the tap. Then there's a half Nelson backbreaker from the top by Strong. He gets a two count off that. They fought on the apron. There's a back suplex to Richards through a table on the floor. And then Roderick follows up with the Gibson driver on the floor, tosses him into the crowd, and is hoping for the count out win. And the fans here are helping Davey up so that he can make it in by the count of 19.
It was such a good visual of, like, these fans helping this wrestler. It reminded me of that scene in, like, Spider-Man 2. Remember, like, the subway fight with Dr. Octopus? And then, like, it turned, you know, it's the civilians who help Spider-Man afterwards from falling off the train tracks.
Yes, that's what this was modeled after.
Yes.
Davey makes it in at 19. Roderick falls with another Gibson driver and then into the Boston Crab. It's reversed into an ankle lock. Strong then reverses. Richards gets a sharpshooter. Strong then transitions to the LaBelle lock, the omoplata crossface, and then he gets out of that. Richards applies an ankle lock, but he lets go due to exhaustion. And Roderick follows with an end of heartache and the sick kick, delivers a second sick kick for a two count, and then applies the stronghold. And Richards passes out at 30 minutes and 30 seconds. I mean, this was just an insane athletic contest. That's mm-hmm. the best way you can describe it. Two guys that went above and beyond a 10 in this match in terms of just athleticism. They were on point throughout all of this.
Yep.
Davey Richards, for all the grief this guy gets about just the personality, he was the ultimate babyface in this match. And this crowd loved him. And it was just, it's an example of a guy who may not be a great promo, but absolutely had this connection.
I really didn't think his promo, like, from what little I saw of it, at least in the opening package, he sounded better than Roderick, I thought. You know, he sounded, again, more like a convincing athlete. I mean, you watch this match, and he really comes across as somebody really special. And I was actually to the point surprised that they didn't put the title on him, because everything about him, like, he did fantastically. Everything, all of his striking looked great. All of his, just his wrestling was just technically, like, perfect in everything that he did.
So, and at this point, Davey was still, he was working with New Japan Pro Wrestling, going over there pretty frequently, and I think part of the idea was not putting the title on him at that particular time, though they would a couple months later in June of the following year. Bobby Cruz then states that officials are concerned that Richards has a concussion and he's bleeding from his right ear. They sold this loss as devastating, and Eddie Edwards and Kyle O'Reilly walk him to the back, and they really played this off like this was, like, they really hit the sport element of this really hard.
I mean, you definitely notice a lot of MMA influence, especially in the selling of this post-fight, you know, concussion thing. And, you know, Richards here basically does, you know, he sells this, like, you know, the MMA post KO or post concussion thing that always happens where you see a guy get knocked out or submitted. And then he wakes up and he realizes then, after everybody else realizes, that he just lost and
shoots for a takedown on Todd Sinclair.
Yeah, or something like that. And you can clearly see that this is, you know, the influence. And I mean, you know, it's happened to me. Like, last time I was in a competition, I got choked out cold. And, you know, you wake up and it's like you're, it's just exactly like the feeling of waking up in the morning, like when you're in bed, except you're like waking up in the middle of an arena, you know? And it's so confusing. And I thought he did a pretty good job here. Again, like, it's a modern way of telling pro wrestling stories.
Well, having to follow that was Kevin Steen and El Generico. Of course, these two forever linked together, coming up through the Quebec wrestling scene and then really getting a big splash in Ring of Honor with Pro Wrestling Guerrilla. And then it was at the 2009 final battle that Steen turned on Generico, and it started off the next year of these two feuding with one another. This ended up being voted a feud of the year by the Observer Newsletter for 2010. And these two were very hands-on with the booking of their particular feud, and certainly Kevin Steen, he's been very outspoken about butting heads with Jim Cornette and vice versa. And this was a peak point of the feud, involving Generico's mask on the line against Kevin Steen's ROH career.
From just the, again, they had another recap video here. It just seemed like Steen, you know, as always, a very good heel. And I'm surprised, but not really so much so, but I'm surprised that Generico is able to play such a great babyface without talking here.
Yeah, I mean, he has always had that that ability as just an incredible, sympathetic babyface. Very much...
without even talking.
Yeah, I agree. There were streamers here for Generico. They're singing the Olay song done to his entrance music. And then the match begins. They go to the floor right away and are brawling. And Steen is busted open from the forehead within the first 4 minutes of this match and getting significant color out of this this particular cut. Generico pulls out a table and a ladder, and Generico is powerbombed on the edge of the apron. And Steen would proceed to lick his own blood off his arm and then bury Generico under the ROH barricade banners. And he wipes his blood on the camera.
This shit was so gross.
It would get even worse.
Like, ugh, gross.
I mean, the idea was Kevin Steen is the ultimate scumbag. Like, this guy has zero redeeming qualities about himself. And he pushed that hard in this match.
And obviously zero concern for hepatitis.
Well, it is his best friend. So if you can't lick your best friend's blood, whose blood can you lick? He throws the steel barricade at Generico and misses on the floor. They're in the ring. The ladder is draped on the middle ropes, and Generico takes a back body drop onto it. We see the pop-up powerbomb by Steen, who then whips a chair at him in the corner, hits a cannonball to Generico with a chair in front, and then he's ripping at the mask, kind of an ode to the Eddie Guerrero Rey Mysterio hair versus mask match.
It was a great visual.
Or title versus mask.
It was a great visual to see that half-torn mask on Generico's face for the rest of this match.
We saw a somersault leg drop onto the chair, and you can see Generico is busted open pretty significantly at this point.
Yeah.
And this is where Steen wipes his hand on Generico's face full of blood and then licks Generico's blood from his own hand.
Oh.
Wow, we've got the China.
I swear, this is
vomiting.
Definitely the closest I've come to watching a review and dry heaving since the fucking China porn. Like, it was so disgusting.
He attacks Generico with a chain. He covers his hand and arms with Generico's blood. This is...
He writes die on his arm with the blood on his forehead.
Following Jerry Lynn's footsteps with the die. The die was cast in this particular match. You know, for all the people that argue about oh, this is awesome. Why'd they get rid of blood? It's like, you are not making a strong argument that this is missing
this
from today's pro wrestling.
Fucking excessive to me, okay? Maybe I just have a weaker stomach for some of this stuff. But I don't know if I enjoyed watching this match.
He kisses Generico. And then the scoop slam is blocked, and Generico slams him onto the ladder, then delivers a half Nelson suplex onto the ladder for a two count. This may have been the first pin attempt after about 18 minutes at this point. The ladder is then draped on the apron and the barricade, and Steen places a table on top of that. So we've got like the double-decker deal with the ladder underneath the table, raised above the floor. Generico leaps between the ladder and the table into a tornado DDT. Think the same spot he now does under the second turnbuckle onto the floor. This was incredible.
Yeah.
Like, to be able to thrust yourself through that distance and then hit a tornado DDT, a pretty spectacular spot, and left the ladder and chair, or the ladder and the table in place.
Yeah.
Then Generico misses with a kick in the corner. They fought on the turnbuckle. Steen gets sent off the top through the stacked table and the ladder on the floor. Generico then hits a package pile driver in the ring, Steen's finish, and gets a two count on Steen, delivers a brain buster, and then Steve Corino runs down to stop Todd Sinclair from counting three and clotheslines Generico, knocks out Todd Sinclair, and then he gets a chair, but Colt Cabana, who's been aligned with Generico throughout this whole time, pulls Corino out, and he has the chair, and you're thinking, here comes the turn. But no, he blasts Steen in the head with the chair. Steen kicks out of
Did they tease that? Did they tease that Colt might?
No, I mean, it was the trademark spot of the guy who's got the chair, yeah, and he's going to turn his hips and hit the other guy,
right,
which would have made no fucking sense, but no one would have seen it coming.
Yeah.
So the match continues after Steen kicks out of the chair shot. Generico misses with a running kick, takes out Todd Sinclair from the apron going to the floor. Steen hits a package pile driver, and referee Bryce Remsburg runs in for a two count. He then takes a package pile driver, and the second referee is knocked out. We got a package pile driver onto the chair. Paul Turner runs in and Generico kicks out and then drops Steen on the exposed turnbuckle, hits a Yakuza kick in the corner, brainbuster onto the top turnbuckle for another near fall. Generico then goes for a chair shot. Steen puts his hands up and has his hands on the mask and is begging off of Generico, and Generico contemplates whether he is going to spare Kevin Steen, and he thinks about it, and then he blasts Kevin Steen in the head with the chair shot, and he pins him at 31 minutes and 13 seconds, and Cabana comes back to hold up Generico's arm in victory.
Yeah.
Did I get everything?
You did. You did a very good job of that, too.
There was a lot in this match.
Yeah. I thought some very effective storytelling here. A match that really felt like it was a conclusive ending to a feud. I think just watching this match without really following much of the storyline, you can really feel like, wow, these guys really fucking got carried away here with a lot of shit. They did a lot of shit here, okay, and a lot of disgusting shit. But I think if you take into account that this is the culmination of a one-year storyline, and really, you know, a lifelong storyline between these two people, you know, you can't really, you can understand, you know, and you can justify them doing all this stuff.
I think you could make a really strong argument that the fact they were following Roderick Strong and Davey Richards, which you knew was going to have all those near falls, and that match really, I think, needed a lot of that. Mm. This match, if this was me, I think you could have done most of these spots.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, there's such hatred between these two that they just want to destroy the other. And they kill each other, and they kill each other, and you still build up to the final chair spot, and that is the only pinfall attempt in the entire match, which is the finish.
Sure.
One pinfall.
Yeah.
There's no. Why do you want to end? You want to kill this guy, well, more so than even winning the match.
I wonder how that would play out. I don't know if I've ever seen a match where that has gone that long with only one pin attempt, but I wonder how that would play out. But I'll definitely say that a lot of the near falls that they tried here didn't really get a big reaction. Like that first brainbuster that he went for, nobody bought it. You know, you have a fucking table and a ladder set up in the corner, and you go for your you know, a finisher. No one's going to buy your first near fall.
The art of these matches are that you can get it's it's a growing reaction to near falls, but it hits a ceiling. And once you hit that ceiling, people are numb to it, and then you see it dissipate.
And it's also, you know, in this case, it could be a case of them being not close enough to that ceiling and people just, you know, not buying it. I think expectations are so high that we're going to see at least five near falls before we actually get the near fall. But, you know, overall, this was not my favorite match on the show. My favorite match on the show was the Strong and Richards match. And for this one to follow it, it certainly looked like the storytelling was very good. But I think it might have been a case where a bit of a buffer would have really helped between the two matches. I think that match was just very good, very emotional, and they went very, very long as well as this one. So for this one to follow right after, maybe kind of took some wind out of it for me.
It's tough because it's almost like you're not even reviewing this based on a 31-minute window. They had just watched that last match, so it's almost like it was 60 minutes of, you know, incredible stuff and near falls and... I mean, an audience is – this is also at the 3-plus-hour mark of a show. So it's very trying. But to their credit, this crowd was chanting match of the year afterwards. Yeah. Thank you, Steen. And we should note the post-match here. They're all singing the goodbye song to Steen before chanting thank you, Steen. And then Steen just yells, fuck you all, as he leaves.
And they cheer him even louder.
It was great.
Yeah.
And, you know, for all the stuff that's been said, and we're going to hear from Jim Cornette in a few minutes here, I mean, I think that these two, in a weird way, it did bring about some great stuff that translated on camera. Steen would return later the following year, and then in 2012... I mean, Steen was arguably, in my opinion, he was at his most over in 2012 as the anti-authority figure who was opposite Jim Cornette on television. And I think those two produced a lot of great chemistry that was built on legitimate dislike of each other. They had very different philosophies towards pro wrestling. And there were arguments back and forth, pro, con, and the truth was somewhere in the middle. But I thought these two truly did bring out a lot of good in one another. And Steen, I think, really did benefit a lot from, you know, he was very upset because they took him off television for a prolonged period of time. He was still kept on the payroll on a monthly deal.
You're talking about after this.
After this. So they had to take him off television to sell the story. And he was still paid, but he was hoping he'd be back on programming a lot earlier than he was. And he had... They wanted him to lose weight as well, and they did have plans for him when he was coming back. But it was a bad period involving both. And they've gone on many interviews talking about one another and how difficult it was to work with the other. But that was some of the backstory. But that wraps up Final Battle 2010 with a bonus segment at the end involving Roderick Strong confronting Truth Martini backstage, telling him that you made me look like a fucking idiot. And then kicked the cameraman out.
Mm-hmm.
Had to go off the show with this.
Hey, what are you doing there? Get out of here. Yeah, one of those.
Some fine work.
Yeah. Yeah, overall, I really enjoyed watching this show. You know, I think it's been a while since I've seen a full ROH show on this podcast. And it was really nice. The level of work is just so high. And we're really getting to a point, like I said, where this style is finally kind of getting the respect that it deserves in the mainstream. You know, you've seen like, you know, basically doing matches like this, you know, every single week now on TV. And I think it's important for people to know, you know, that this stuff was happening in ROH for 10 plus years. And it was a good show. I give it like an 8 out of 10.
Yeah, I'm at the same. 8 out of 10. All right, we're now going to hear a little bit from Jim Cornette, who was heavily involved with Ring of Honor at this particular time on the creative side and as well as on camera. So here's Jim Cornette discussing this time period at the end of 2010 for Ring of Honor. Final Battle 2010, which was a very interesting time period for Ring of Honor. You were right in the middle of it all. It was about 6 months before the announcement with Sinclair. And at that point, World's Greatest Tag Team was just announcing their return to the promotion. A lot of great tag teams at that point.
Yep.
Where was Jim Cornette's mindset at that point? December 2010, this was pre-Sinclair. You had had enough time where you clearly had you know, a lot of your ideas being implemented at that point. Where was Ring of Honor in that point at the end of 2010, as you can recall?
I thought it was in a great spot. I thought, performance-wise, the guys were knocking it out of the park on most of the shows. We had a lot of great talent. This was pre-Sinclair purchase.
Yes.
But not pre-Sinclair discussions.
Right.
So that was right when HDNet was going to go away. We found out at Christmas time that the HDNet program was not going to be renewed. But it was also when the Sinclair talks were, I believe, starting in earnest. So we kind of hoped that there would be just a transition period there. And, I thought that with the shows drawing well and internet pay-per-view looking good, I thought the sky was the limit at that point in time. And especially when Sinclair Broadcasting bought the company, I thought, we're going to get away from Go Fight Live and do real quality internet pay-per-views. This is a cash cow. We're going to be on television exposing this brand new, exciting style of wrestling with these new faces that haven't been beat to death on national television, hitting each other hard and treating wrestling seriously. And then, of course, budgetary constraints got in the way of all of that stuff. But at Christmas time there, we were looking good.
It was really something to watch this show back, and just the tag division at that point. I mean, you had the Kings of Wrestling as kind of the franchise tag team, the Briscoe Brothers.
Actually, that was the Midnight Express spot. They were the closest thing I had seen to a heel tag team that could go and have matches like the Midnight Express. And with the Briscoes on the other side as you know, the homegrown Ring of Honor talent, and I love the Briscoes to this day. They're an incredible, and somebody you couldn't write. They're
exactly
legitimate, great tag team, great personalities. Haas and Benjamin. We had a great tag team roster there, and really had just started to tap the surface of it when, unfortunately, right at the same time Sinclair purchase happened, they made offers for Claudio and Hero in WWE Developmental. And I knew what was going to happen, and so did Delirious, and we talked about it. They're going to love Claudio because they're going to look at his body. And then Chris Hero's a tremendous worker and guy who largely trained Claudio, and they're going to find a reason not to like him because his body. And they're never going to have another tag team match together. It broke my heart as a fan of tag team wrestling that the Kings of Wrestling I knew would never have another tag team match together.
Yeah.
But, you know, and that kind of took, when you take an important part out of the puzzle, that you know, that harms the whole thing, and that took an important part out of our tag team puzzle when we lost the Kings there right at the start of television.
In a weird way, did that ability to just adjust on the fly to unforeseen circumstances, I mean, did that kind of, was that something that, coming out of Ohio Valley Wrestling, I mean, it seemed like it was the running joke that they
yes.
would just mess with your plans, that you were forced to have to just wake up and, like Dana White said, every day I step out of bed, I step into shit.
Well, Danny Davis started calling me the weasel because I could figure out a way to weasel out of any predicament that the WWE's lack of respect for our business and our booking put us in. I would explain it some way where people would actually go, oh, okay, I can see that. It was like a mental test, a brain teaser.
It seemed to be, the Bashams to me were always the ultimate one. I mean, here they are.
Yeah, I pushed them for 2 years. I said, you got to take these guys. They're a great tag team. You got to take these guys. They're a great tag team. They wouldn't touch them. I break them up to feud with each other in my main events all summer, and that's when they bring them up to be a tag team.
Oh, it's just something
So
else.
I explained it.
That could be your next book project.
I explained it that Doug Basham, the heel in the piece in OVW, was persecuting the Damaja by making him be his brother on national TV and making him be his second banana, and it was all because Doug Basham's evil female accomplice Nikita had obviously performed sexual favors for John Laurinaitis, and they bought it.
So thank you to Jim Cornette for stopping by Review Away. And now we're going to head over to the Law message board and get your feedback to this show. Do you want to kick us off, Way?
Not really.
Okay, then I'll go. Javier from Brooklyn Park. I've always enjoyed the Steen-Generico feud, and I feel that WWE hasn't done more with the feud in NXT, although injuries have kiboshed it. Well, that is a reason, because that's what they were doing at the time when Zayn got hurt. I don't understand why talented guys like TJ Perkins and the Wolves wouldn't jump at the chance of going to TNA when now they all have no direction. Do you guys know if it's bullshit that Davey says TNA was always the better option and that he had no interest in WWE? Well, him and Eddie Edwards did do actually television matches for NXT prior to joining TNA, and they didn't sign them. So they went to TNA, which was their next best option.
Yeah, who knows, you know, what how they truly feel. You know.
They also went to TNA where it was, I mean, that was only a year and a half ago, and TNA was a drastically different company 18 months ago than it is today.
Yeah. I mean, but I really do have to wonder, like, let's say if they did have, I'm sure creative freedom has a lot to do with it too, but let's say they did have the creative freedom, would they not go to the WWE? I feel like that's probably where most of the money is, most of your, but who knows? Of course you're going to say that. Okay, we go to Gonzalo from Minneapolis who says, is it fair to say that Roderick Strong is the most criminally overlooked guy in ROH? I feel his work currently is a lot better than it would have been nice, and it would have been nice to see him in the G1. I think Kevin Kelly is a modest play-by-play guy, but is so much better with Carino nowadays. I think Jim Cornette wasn't the right person for the book, and although this card was fine, his decreasing touch would show itself by the end of his term. It would have been way better had Paul Heyman gone to ROH at this time than TNA, because the direction he would work for, the direction he had would work for this product.
In terms of Roderick Strong, I think the guy gets a lot of credit. He's having perhaps the best year of his career this year with, I mean, just match after match this year. I mean, if you've been following Roderick Strong throughout 2015, I mean, I've always think he's a very talented performer, and I think he's having a phenomenal 2015.
Is there something that about him that's missing? That he need.
I think to be honest, to me, he's never clicked as that kind of having that main event heel promo, that presence about him. But I feel this year, I think his character development has come quite a long way in the past number of years. And I think this year, you really just see so much clicking with him, in particular in Ring of Honor. Next up is Chris Lewis from Ottawa, Illinois. Being there live made this show extra special to me. I've been following Steen and Generico from day one, so every time they wrestle each other, I just enjoy it so much. Beyond that match, I felt like the rest of the card was incredible. Thanks for revisiting a very special night of mine.
We go to Fernando from Andover. I really enjoyed the show, and although ROH has lost many of the talent from this card, they've been able to stock up on talent and broker inter-promotional deals that TNA has lacked for so long. Watching Sarah Del Rey, you can see her fingerprints on the women of NXT. Steen and Generico was a good match, but their ladder war match from Final Battle 2012 is one of the best in their feud, and I feel has raised the bar for their matches. Two questions. Why is it taking so long for WWE to sign Adam Cole? Do you guys know how long his deal is? And two, will the rising competition between NXT and ROH make Ring of Honor less willing to lend WWE some of their footage when documenting current talent?
First off, on Adam Cole, I mean, they're very aware of Adam Cole. He's gone through tryouts. I can't give you a direct answer why he hasn't been signed, because he looks, you know, he's the kind of performer I would think that they would be very aggressive over getting.
How much do you think nowadays the size issue is a question for WWE?
I think
there's still large men on that roster.
I think it's always going to be an issue. I think it's always going to be prevalent. But I think they've somewhat relaxed it. I think that even from, as we were talking about with Richards and Edwards, I'm sure that was a strike against them at that time, and I don't know how much more open-minded they would be. This is NXT. I mean, they decided they weren't going to sign Ricochet, which is nuts. That was only a year ago. I think they're much more open-minded towards the size issue. But, I mean, it's a big leap to the main roster. I mean, everyone was saying, oh, you guys are being so pessimistic when it came to Neville. And he's kind of fit into a role that we kind of assumed he would be on the main roster. And, you know,
do they need another Neville?
That was the argument with Ricochet, was that we've got our quota of small high flyers, and Ricochet, that's how they viewed him at, and didn't see the need to sign him at the time. So I think the size issue, it's always going to be there unless there's a large philosophical change.
And the second question was about footage.
Footage. I don't know if WWE is necessarily going to be asking them for footage. And Ring of Honor, I mean, they're in a very tough predicament at this point. WWE is going after them extremely hard, more aggressively than I feel WWE even went after TNA at any point in time. They clearly view Ring of Honor as the promotion they are fighting rather than a TNA or anybody else in the U.S. So
what does that all stem from?
I thought
they had a good working relationship at one point.
Well, I think it was certainly increased by the Destination America deal, because when you go on cable, WWE takes notice. And that was the same reaction when Wrestling Society X started on MTV. It was all of a sudden, we're going to have ECW, which was going head-to-head with it. We're going to have Vince McMahon going on Tuesday nights to combat.
But they were on HDNet for like years before that, around this time.
I don't think they looked at HDNet was in so fewer homes at that particular time period. I don't think they necessarily... they just didn't look at Ring of Honor in the same light as they do now with Destination America. And I think it's a combination of things. It's the Destination America deal. It's the fact that they secured that action figure deal, and they're going to be putting out a Kevin Steen figure.
Right.
I mean, that's egg on their face that this company is going to be putting out a Steen figure, one of their guys. And three is they're going into Brooklyn on SummerSlam weekend, and yeah, the WWE is compounding them hard.
But again, that's something they've done for years on WrestleMania.
Yeah, and they believe me, the WWE, they've never been cool with it. Right. I mean, they had that city ordinance to try and block out any competing wrestling shows from being in the proximity, and they have the right to do that if they feel people are kind of just mooching in on their pie. WWE is not a company that wants to leave any pennies on the table for other promotions to grab.
Yeah, I do just wonder, like, what are the reasons why it's happening now? Because, you know, remember, like, on .com, like, they did that article on ROH, kind of talking about the history of the show and of ROH. And, you know, on the Punk DVD and I think a little bit on the Bryan DVD, they're always praising ROH, too. Like, they never paint the company in a bad light.
Well, the difference was, you know, even 2 years ago, they weren't necessarily competing for those same fans that watch Ring of Honor. Now we have NXT, which... Mm-hmm. It's our Ring of Honor. Mm-hmm. That's what WWE believes, and we are going after that audience that Ring of Honor is going for. We now have a direct head-to-head battle on many different fronts. Mm. So I think it's going to be very aggressive. Now you see the Ring of Honor's their All-Star Extravaganza show in September. They're going to be NXT is now running a head-to-head show in San Antonio in September. I think you're going to see a lot of that.
Wow.
Rob from Saskatoon. Generico and Steen, my all-time favorite feud. I will never say no to those two stepping in the ring together with each other. We all know these two guys can work a fine technical match, but this match needed to be a fight, and that's exactly what this main event was. I thought the Steen control segment in the middle was a touch on the dull side, but other than that, there was nothing I can say bad about this match. I'd put this match at about 4.5 stars, and it is still only my third or fourth favorite Steen and Generico match. Strong and Richards did the Davey Richards trademark of going 5 minutes too long, and Daisy Hayes really needs to eat something. Scary skinny. Off topic, both John and Way were very vocal about how they did not want the Pan Am Games happening in Toronto. Now that the games are over, did you guys survive? And thoughts on the strong rumors of Toronto bidding for the 2024 Summer Olympic Games?
I don't know if we were vocal about that.
I think there was a lot of...
I'm indifferent.
I think a lot of people were thinking it was going to be a giant nuisance for traffic in Toronto. And I've got to say, like, I don't commute every day to work, so I didn't have to really endure it. It seemed that there was a lot of volume on the roads, but traffic wasn't insane or anything. At least I didn't encounter any of it.
Yeah, again, I don't really commute that much either, so I can't really say. Although I did notice the airport when I got back from Vegas was very busy, largely because of this.
I do not want the Olympics coming here.
Yeah, I don't know if I want that.
The Olympics
either.
Are a different animal than the Pan Am Games.
Yeah, I don't know why everybody in the city has such a hard-on for getting the Olympics. It's... You know, I don't know. It's not, we're not a sports podcast.
No, we're
How about
not.
A WrestleMania?
Huh? Yeah, not with the dollar where it's at right now. Yeah. Last one.
Okay, we go to Brad from Whitby. Now, I would never call the current ROH production as world-class, but my God, is it kilometers better than the 2010 product. This was the first true Colt Cabana match I've ever seen, and now I understand his appeal. This one wasn't so much a match as Colt dicking around, and it was hilarious. The main event was pretty brutal for a hardcore match in ROH, but the excessive amounts of blood was a bit of a turnoff. Steen writing on this on his arm with his own blood was one thing, but licking his hand after it was covered in El Generico's blood was downright nauseating. You might want to get yourself checked out, Kevin. The wrestling was very good in this match, and I wish these two could use some of the moves now in the WWE, like the package pile driver and the top turnbuckle neckbreaker, but I understand why the WWE would ban these moves. Final Battle was a great choice, guys.
All right, that's going to bring an end to the greatest review away of all time.
No.
A 12 out of 10 show.
By the time we edit this, it'll probably be like 30 minutes.
We're going to have to take out the crap. All right. Well, that's going to wrap us up. Next week, I've already forgotten what we agreed to review. What was it again? That's right.
Yes.
The G1. We're going to review every single G1 match in history, dating back to 1991. We're going to do about 1,000 matches. No, that's not true. New Japan World, they have recently posted all of the finals from every G1, starting with the very first G1 in 1991. So me and Wei have selected 5 finals that we are going to review. So you have the next week where you can go back and watch these 5 matches and we'll do a little history lesson on these particular years and their significance.
And we'll throw the list up on the message board so you guys can find it.
Yes. We're going to do 1991, 1996, 2004, 2007, and 2012. So a nice...
Can you just give a little taste of some of the matches we might...
91, which is the first year, we've got Masahiro Chono, Mr. August himself, taking on...
Keiji Muto.
I wrote the wrong name down here. 1996, we've got Riki Choshu taking on Masa Chono. 2004 is Hiroyoshi Tenzan and a young Hiroshi Tanahashi. And then 2007, it's Tanahashi Yuji Nagata. And then 2012, it's Kazuchika Okada and Carl Anderson.
Great.
So that is what we are going to be reviewing next week, those 5 matches.
And we're hoping that this is like, you know, sort of almost a bit of a retrospective on New Japan's history, you know, at least back to 1991.
Yeah.
And we might even have a guest.
Yes, we're working on getting Masa Chono in studio to discuss the tournament that he'll forever be linked to, the G1 Climax.
Sure. And maybe we'll get his take on traffic in Toronto as well.
That's true. That is true. Okay, so that's going to wrap up the show. Thanks to all of you for tuning in. You can always go to liveaudiowrestling.com for all of our shows. We've got The Law up from Sunday night involving our whole breakdown of the Hulk Hogan story.
Great show.
Thank you.
Yep,
we've got sure. Jake Roberts reacting to the story, Dave Meltzer on the show discussing it, and then an interview with Jim Cornette.
And Title Bout Trivia.
Did you enjoy Title Bout Trivia?
I love Title Bout Trivia.
I thought you would get a kick out of that. Yep. Jason Agnew went above and beyond this past week. And then Monday night, we got Wei Ting's reaction to the Hulk Hogan story. You had been silent since Friday. You finally let it all out on Monday's Review of Raw. And it's Wednesday, so you still have time to go back, watch the Fight Network version, which you can do so at youtube.com/Fight Network, look for the secret question, and then you can tweet the answer at Law Radio. And this week we are giving away another copy of Daniel Bryan's book entitled Yes. Last week we gave away a book to a listener, viewer in England.
Mm-hmm.
So our shipping department was just loving me the other day when they informed me.
How much is that going to cost?
They were like, is this a priority to send over immediately? Because it'll be $100. I said,
what?
I said, it's not a priority.
Okay.
Pick the cheapest option.
It would actually be cheaper if we ordered the book from Amazon and just sent the dude the
book. Okay. I completely blamed Wei for picking someone from England. But
well, it was a random draw.
Hey,
so.
It's open to everyone. If you are Masahiro Chono and you want this book in English, you can submit the secret answer to the secret question. That's what we need, the secret answer, where we have to find it. That'd be a Vince Russo contest for you.
Damn, nobody would see it coming.
All right, so go check all of that out. Go follow Wei's fine life at Wei0937. Always an entertaining follow on Instagram, on Twitter, in life as in general. Give him some motivation to find that passion, find that smile. The reason he wakes up every morning and puts on that Gracie Jiu-Jitsu hoodie that I purchased for him, the only Christmas present he's ever worn.
Because you've made me feel guilty about it.
Well, I would. I would. And myself, I'm doing all my G1 shows. This week actually isn't too bad. There was a show yesterday. There's a show today. And then they have Thursday and Friday off. So it's not too bad this week.
Cool.
That is it for us. We will chat with you next week with a review of 5 G1 finals. So go check those matches out. And we will be back next week with an even better review away.
Oh, my goodness! Right in the crotch!